Let's welcome Swapnil.
Swapnil.
Swapnil. He is talking about building an IoT platform with Apache Apollo and Apache Geode. Right.
Thank you. Hi all. As he said, I am Swapnil. I am a committer on Apache Geode. So in this presentation, we are actually going to look. I'll just briefly touch over what building a platform for IoT would mean, and see how these technologies could be leveraged into. Give an introduction, I guess, first of all, into all these technologies, and then introduce briefly on how you could use them to build a scalable platform for IoT. So for a typical IoT case, right? So you have these devices which are represented here as a factory. So devices in a factory sending messages out to a broker, and then those messages are then processed to derive business value. So that's basically IoT in a nutshell, right? So what are the things that you need to consider while building the IoT platform? So the first thing would be how your devices are talking to your brokers, right? So basically the protocol that you should use. Once you've figured out the protocol, then you need to figure out what sort of a broker are you going to use that handles that protocol well. And then you need to figure out, so how would you actually go about processing the data that arrives at the broker? And through all these steps, the thing to keep in mind is how would you really scale this platform, because you may very well end up with millions of devices sending data to you. So let's talk about the protocol briefly, right? So the protocol that has the most buzz around it nowadays is MQTT. It stands for Message Queuing Telemetry Transport, and it was designed from the ground up to actually work with the IoT devices, right? So it is very optimized. It is a binary protocol. And by optimized, I mean the overhead that MQTT introduces is fairly minimal. It's actually just 2 bytes. So an MQTT message would be, your entire payload with just 2 bytes of headers, and that's all that there is to it. It is based on TCP, so it is important to note that you would, your client side would also need to have the TCP stack. So the good news here is if you used something like Apache Minute, it supports the TCP stack. So your devices could be running on that, and you should be good to go. So I guess one of the fallouts of being highly optimized is there isn't really a type system. So, because the header is only 2 bytes, right? So the payload that you're sending from your devices to the broker is all binary data at that point. So one of the advantages also of using MQTT over some of the other protocols is the quality of service levels that it guarantees. So there essentially are three. So it supports a fire and forget, which, as the name says, so send a message, you don't know if it reached the broker or not. The second level it supports is at least at least once guarantee. So which means that you are sure that your message was delivered to the broker at least once. It may be delivered more than once, but your broker got the message at least once. And there also is a exactly once guarantee, which again, as the name suggests, is guarantee that broker sees it only one time and no more, no less, right? And this all is actually handled by the protocol. So in your application, you don't really have to do much, right? So you just say, you just have to specify what QoS level you need, and the underlying protocol just takes care of the rest. So MQTT is also highly energy efficient. So there were some benchmarks where people took, people had workloads on MQTT and they switched the underlying protocol then to send data over HTTP and over WebSockets. So what they found was they were able to get 7 times as many messages sent using MQTT. And even then, they ended up using 10% less battery on the devices. So it is battery friendly as well. So all good things, I guess. So once you have the protocol, you would then need to figure out what sort of a broker that you would need to read, or to be able to read all that data. So ActiveMQ Artemis is I guess, so it's a sub project of ActiveMQ, and the optimization that it has over ActiveMQ is the underlying architecture was actually changed to be non-blocking, so that makes it highly performant. As you can see from the architecture diagram of Artemis, it actually supports multiple protocols. It is fairly easy to plug in your own protocol also. But the good news is it actually does support MQTT out of the box, in addition to AMQP, Stomp, OpenWire, and HornetQ. So the protocol side is fairly covered. So one of the other advantages is you don't really have to run it as a standalone process. You can actually embed ActiveMQ Artemis inside your application, and I'll briefly touch upon why that is important, I guess. And you can actually also set up multiple of the ActiveMQ servers in a cluster, and that would enable your brokers to scale horizontally. And so when you're trying to deal with a whole bunch of clients, that comes in handy. So for getting the performance, right, they actually also say the persistence layer was of critical importance, right? So the persistence that it supports is journal, which writes to the local file system. And for writing it, they say they use the append-only files for writing stuff on disk, which are pre-created and pre-filled by buffers. So you know it is extremely fast. It's just no disk seeks, right? It just goes on writing data. And they also support JDBC. So the persistence layer is fairly pluggable, right? So that is one of the advantages that we would need, as I would refer to. So, I guess in terms of scaling, right? So when you do have all these devices trying to talk to your broker, as I referred to earlier, what you could do is you could set up an Artemis cluster. And when it is horizontally scaled, you should be able to handle all the data from your devices without any problem. So one of the advantages of this approach also is the clients are actually load balanced across the entire cluster. And so yeah, I guess you get horizontal scalability at that point. So once you do have your brokers horizontally scalable, your processors of information, right? They still are the bottleneck if you only have one. So what you now need to figure out is how do you go about scaling those processors, right? But the problem here would be, so if your business logic is inside the processors, now you would all of a sudden have to get distributed coordination between the processors, because none of the processors is going to see all of the data, right? The data is actually, since it's ends up in a queue, right? So you get some data in processor one, some in processor two, and some in processor three. So to make to get a holistic picture of what your devices are telling you, you actually need then some sort of a coordination. So I guess at this point you could potentially then use something on the back end to write data from all the processors. But what I thought was it would be interesting to see how I can potentially use Artemis to also get that similar functionality going, right? And so since the persistence layer of Artemis is pluggable, I thought it would be interesting to see if I can actually extend it to see to use Geode, and doing that would basically enable me to then analyze all that data in parallel and make sense of it all. So I'm actually then going to talk about what exactly Geode is, right? Geode is the open source version of a product called Gemfire. So Gemfire product has been, out in the market since 2004. And it was donated to ASF 2 years ago, at the conference in Austin 2 years ago. Since then we have graduated from the incubator just last November. Regarding the name, right? So as with Geodes, our project is rock solid, so you can really depend on it. It is tried and tested. It's been out there and been used in the industry for a long time now, and it really shines in its performance, right? So that's why the name. What is it exactly, right? It is essentially an in-memory distributed data grid. So since it is distributed and in memory, you get high performance, scalability, and all the good things, right? You also get event-driven architecture. So we'll actually talk about all these in the next slides. So it is, I just wanted to bring this up because it is implied that an in-memory system is faster than a non-disk system, but just to drive the point, I guess, and to be able to make sense of it all, right? So this is one of the slides of latency numbers from Jeff Dean. So it says the main memory reference takes about 100 nanoseconds, and a disk seek is about 10 milliseconds. So both small numbers, and at this point you'd be like, what is the big advantage, I guess, right? So if you convert these numbers to seconds, so if you say the main memory reference is actually takes 100 seconds, then the equivalent time for doing a disk seek is 115 days. So the difference between, I guess, just trying to drive the point that in-memory systems are really, really fast. So who all are the users? So as I said, the project has been out for quite a while. So GE actually uses Geode in their IoT use cases. So they have a lot of their wind turbines sending data to Geode, and all of that information is then analyzed in Geode. So they have about 17 billion records in memory at any point of time in their Geode clusters. Geode is also used by the Chinese and the Indian railways for their online reservation system. So it's an in-memory data grid, right? So it also is able to stand in between your application, so in between your web application and your database tier. So your application never talks to the database, essentially. You know, it just your application talks to Geode, and then Geode takes care of synchronizing your transactions with the backend database. And having done that, right, so the Chinese Railways does about 4.6 million transactions a day on Geode, and the Indian Railways says that it can handle 120,000 users without any problems. So since you know, if you take the population, right, so you could fairly say that you know, Geode reaches or makes life somewhat better for 36% of humanity. So if you're looking to contribute to a project that has an impact on humanity, look no further. Apache Geode. All contributions welcome. Right? Okay. So so how does it actually store the data? So the data is stored in just a concurrent hash map. We call the concurrent hash map a region because there is a JSR spec for JCache, which actually called it a region. Since then, they have moved away from that terminology, but I guess because we have a lot of users already, we are stuck with that name. So to briefly explain, right, there are two types of maps or regions that you can create in Geode. You can choose to partition the data across a bunch of servers, and so that scales horizontally, right? So at that point, you're just adding nodes. As soon as you add node, the data rebalances, and this cluster scales horizontally. You'll be able to handle increasing amounts of data. You can also choose to just replicate the data on all the nodes of the system. So the entire map is replicated. And that is necessary when, say, you have, you know, some sort of lookup data that you're using in your computations all the time, right? The lookup data is really important because, so what Geode provides is functionality to run your application code within the server process. So you can, in a, you can write functions, as we call them, register them with us, and then those functions are just analyzing the local data to arrive at results. And at this point, if you have, you know, some sort of lookup data, it is nice to have that locally. And so for the partition regions, right, so I guess it's kind of like MapReduce at this point. So you are analyzing data on partition regions and then able to send the results back to the client. And again, all of this computation runs in the process with the servers, so there is no extra overhead, and it's all really fast. We also support this notion of a object query language. So so I think I briefly touched on this, right? But what you can store in Geode basically is objects, right? Your regular Java objects. And so if your values are objects, then you could use SQL to query it, but it's not really powerful enough, right? So I guess you could, so I guess with OQL, right, you could actually do something similar. You can say select star from my region where the status is active. And at this point, the status is actually one of the fields on your object. Right. So that part is fairly simple, but your objects are richer than just single value attribute. Your objects could actually have collections in them, or they could have other objects as fields, right? And so how do you query that? And so that's why we decided to extend SQL and come up with the OQL language. And so as apparent from the second example, right? So if you have a person's region, which is storing your person's or a person domain object, right? And so that object has then a field called pet, which also happens to be an object and has, you know, the name and the type and whatever, right? And other attributes. You can drill down into your objects. Okay. And so as in this case, you can say p.pet dot type is equals to Dino, right? And so that sort of a drilling down into your nested objects is the cool thing that OQL provides you. In addition, you can also just invoke any methods on your domain objects. So it doesn't just have to be attributes on the object; it could be methods as well. So if in the third case, if you had a collection in your domain object called children, you can just do a dot size on it, and that goes in and invokes any method, right? So either attributes or methods, the engine handles both. You can also do joins. The restriction there is you don't actually, so if you were trying to do joins on two partition regions, just because of how the data is laid out, we don't really ship the data to individual nodes to make the join happen. So you could do a join, no problem, between one partition and the other replicates. So joins also are supported. So here is where things get really interesting, I guess. So you can actually have the OQL query registered with the server, and when you register it, it works as a continuous query. So what do I mean by that, right? So from this example, so you say you have this query where select star from your orders where the symbol is something and the price is greater than 100. So you just have that query, you register that with the server, and you have other clients pushing in data into your system. Whenever this particular query gets satisfied, we will then send events to your client to notify that, hey, you know, you were interested in this sort of a scenario, and guess what, that just happened, right? And so at that point, we actually have this interface called CQ or Continuous Query Listener, and your client just gets notified of that event. This notion is highly available. So at any point, your client subscription on the server side, right? So as soon as you register a continuous query, multiple servers then try to remember what events were pushed to a client. So in case one server dies, other server takes its place and sends the events to your client. So it's all highly available. And the one thing we have not talked about yet is what about the deserialization, right? So if you have a domain object and you're drilling down into the domain object for all the attributes, then what does it mean? Do you really need those domain objects on the server's class path for the server to be able to then deserialize them? Well, not really, right? So so the other problem that also was is, so if you have domain objects on the server's class path, it would mean that your schema is pretty fixed, just like the relational table. You could So we were trying to figure out, you know, so how would it really work, right? We didn't really want to get a fixed schema to tie you in, or make it completely flexible. You know, if it were completely flexible, then you would have trouble querying the data, right? So we decided to go somewhat in between, and we have this serialization framework called Portable Data Exchange, which is brief. Which I guess is referred to as PDX. It helps because the airport code for Portland, where most of our team is actually PDX. So, so what is PDX, right? So it actually is, what we do is with each value, we maintain some sort of a metadata, right? And also maintain data about at what offset individual entries live. So you don't really have to deserialize the entire value. So again, if you have something like this, if the query says p.pet.type, on the server side, this whole thing is just one byte array. But as soon as we know that all you are after is the type, we know exactly where that type information is in the byte array. You just go there, deserialize only that one particular value, and answer your query, I guess. So no need to deserialize the entire object. And since all of these are primitives, you don't really need to have your domain objects on the class path at that point.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You said previously that you also can use methods.
Yes. If you do use methods, you would need the domain objects on the class path. So what are the other advantages of this, I guess, right? So one of the problems also was, or with having your domain objects on the class path on the server, is if you are familiar with how class loading works in Java, let me back up. So say you have a domain object, and then you decided to add an additional field to the domain object. So you're basically changing the domain object at that point, right? Since on the server, everything is deserialized, it has the class associated with it. Now, if you go about and change the underlying domain object, you would end up getting a whole bunch of... So, I guess, if you don't want to kill your server and start it back up again, what would happen is you would get class cast exceptions, because even if the name of the domain object is the same, if it is indeed loaded by two different class loaders, then Java is always going to say that, you know, that object, those two objects are not equal, right? So that's another problem with changing your domain type. So if you use PDX, none of that would happen. And you can, at that point, safely change all your application you want, right? Change your domain objects all you want, and still have your cluster up and running at all times. So supporting rolling upgrades and everything is not really a problem. Again, it's easy to use, so no ideal or no schemas, none of that. We support a reflection-based auto-serializer. So what that thing does is, so first time around, you try to serialize an object. You say, well, do I know about this? I don't. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use reflection to figure out all the fields, and then I just serialize those values for you. And we do maintain the type information out on the server, so it's all taken care of. So, having that is good, I guess, but how fast is the serialization? So we ran a benchmark, which is pointed at the URL. So it's a micro benchmark for JVM serializers. And as you can see, they're a little bit slower than Protobuf, I guess, but a whole lot better than the Java's built-in serialization. So this is what I was talking about, PDX, which is spoke about PDX. There was the earlier data serialization format, which does not support queries or anything. It does not support queries, but it is still so it's the fastest way, I guess. So if it's performance that you're after, feel free to use the data serializable and you'll be good. I think I also touched upon this previously, right? So you can evolve your schema. You can actually have multiple applications deployed against Geode. So say an orders application and some sort of a, so you know, the front-facing customer application and then an inventory application, right? They are using the same sort of domain objects, but they can go about and freely change their object schema and they would interoperate without any problems. So having said all that about Geode, how would you actually go about using Geode for IoT, right? So say you have some in your IoT application, right? You're dealing with some sort of telemetry data from machines, and what you want to do is you want to predict when something is going to fail. A couple of ways you can go about doing that, I guess. So what you can also you could say is iterate over all my data, get me the mean of the current reading, whatever that happens to be, the mean and the standard deviation. And once you have that, you can then register a continuous query for incoming data. It says, you know, if the incoming value is happens to be outside one standard deviation, send a notification somewhere, right? And so that would give you a heads up when something is about to fail. You could also have you know, a Markov model, I guess, and a Markov model which will then tell you when a failure is about to happen. So I guess there is a lot of other things you could do. So all this implementation would go into the function that runs in the Geode grid for you. So you know, you're free to really use any sort of analysis method or technique that you want to use. And so yeah, and so you know, if you are computing the standard deviation every so often, then right, you just go back and then you refine your continuous query to reflect the latest standard deviation results, and then you really so that's the, I guess, the analytics feedback loop, right? So you are doing some sort of analytics and then making sure that those are taken into effect for the streaming data. The other thing is time windows, I guess. So you would want to run your analytics potentially on all the data, but for a limited amount of time. So you could say, well, only run this for the last, you know, months data, right? And throw out all the other. What you can do is you can set a time to live on all the entries that are coming into Geode. And so at the end of the time to live period, then you configure whether to just get rid of it, to delete it, or to then persist it onto the disk, right? And all of that is then supported. So that was basically it about how we can use Geode for building a scalable IoT platform. Any questions? Yeah.
Do you have in mind any production use case how Geode is used for IoT solution as an IoT backbone?
Right. Yes. So GE actually uses Geode for their IoT application, right? So they have their wind turbines sending a lot of data into the Geode cluster, and they have about 17 billion data points in the Geode cluster at any point of time.
And what Geode APIs that they used what this data is stored in your cluster
right.
by that company.
Right. So, as far as I know, they actually use the standard deviation model. So they are iterating over all the data, all the 17 billion records in Geode. They compute the mean and the standard deviation, and then on the incoming data, they you know then they're monitoring to see if the incoming data is outside the standard deviation, right? And then they recompute the standard deviation ever so often. So you could just go about you know doing it as fast as you can.
Thanks. And also, a quick question about your PDF serializer.
Mm-hmm.
Is it enabled by default, or I need to turn it off?
It right now is not enabled by default. Good question. Yeah, there is a Jira file asking that same thing, and you know, saying, "Well, PDX should just be by default." And
so like
we just
it should be enabled by default.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last question is: you compare that serializer to other serializers available in the market. Does it mean you? I can use your serializer outside of Geode, or it's bound to the cluster?
So, right now it is bound to the cluster, really. So, there isn't a good way to use it outside, I guess. But again, one of the things that we really want to accomplish in Geode is making Geode modular, so that it, you know. Components can be extracted and plugged in, and you know, so yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah.
So next up in this room, I'm sure something very similar. You maybe with contrast Ignite and Geo a little bit. Really similar.
They are very similar. They are very, very similar. So the question was, is Geode and Ignite similar? And the answer, the short answer is yes.
Okay.
the maturity and, you know, you can drill down into the sort of features that are supported and whatnot, and you can get into that finer grain detail. But broadly speaking, yeah, they are the same. And I can throw in Hazelcast also in that same camp. So it's a in-memory data grid, right? That's what the category is, and there are four main players. So there is Oracle Coherence, there is us, Ignite, and Hazelcast.
Mm-hmm. You can quick note if you want to learn more about Apache Ignite. I represent that community here, and you can come to my next talk.
Oh.
So that you can see what are the differences, what are the similarities.
Awesome, sounds good. Yes?
As far as the geo is concerned, it doesn't really matter how the data is coming from, whether it's MQTT or
it does.
Yeah, CoAP or whatever.
Yeah.
As long as it's JSON encoded or whatever.
It could be JSON encoded, it could be you know just your Java, plain old Java objects, so POJOs. We have clients in Java, C++, .NET.
Yeah, you mentioned Apache MyNewton, you know, it's a really, it sends data in very from constrained systems, so typically they do JSON or
yeah.
you know, C4 or
okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, I was wondering about elasticity in the deployment. Is everything static?
Elasticity?
If you can really scale up now, there's some support.
Yes, of course. So you can bring up additional nodes of the system, and then the data is automatically balanced across the new nodes, right? So if it was a partition map, then a bit of data from potentially a bunch of members get sent to the new member, or replicated, and he ends up getting the copy. So it is. It's highly scalable, and the good thing is, I guess, so we have this process called get initial nuke. So while a member is coming up trying to get data from existing content, even during that time, the member is available for performing your user request. So if at that point your client is we're hitting it for getting some, for getting and putting data.
it's all up and ready. So it's a matter of a couple of seconds after you start up the process that is ready to use.
So you didn't mention streaming or anything. Like you described IoT use cases, but the streaming keyword didn't come out at all.
Sure.
So this type of workloads, right?
So I guess what you, so streaming in a sense, what you could do is, if you say stream, I guess so in my mind, streaming is more like a time window for us, really. So, you know, you are storing.
When you say you iterate over a list of content, basically, the window is that. I mean, unless you saw the type of process function. I mean, I wonder whether there is a match between some use cases in which you need, like, state management, exploit a system like this.
State management?
Yeah, like, we have long-running stream processes, and you have data counting, and you need to distribute and bring it fast. Maybe share it across many windows, rather than having replicate it across all the windows and stuff.
Right.
And, like, that can, like, this could help.
Yeah, that would be, yeah, that would be interesting, I guess. I've not really thought about that case. So, but yeah, sharing data. So I guess there's nothing preventing, you know, you having multiple functions run against the same time window. So against the same map, essentially, right? So you could have you could have one function that is doing a Markov model, for example, right? And then some other function which is computing your standard deviation, and yet another function doing something else entirely, and all of them can operate on the same time window.
Yeah, the idea is actually you have different time windows with different partitioning over the same data stream. Sharing actually the data in a database, I guess, but then duplicating it.
Okay. Yeah, that's
so then that's
yeah.
Really challenging because you have
right.
Random access and sequential reading together,
right.
So it's really tough to find like the winner in these things right now.
I guess so that is something that would not possible, right? So if you can duplicate your data across multiple apps, and then but then again the duplication, right? Just so